Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown, Sleep Tight Stories.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault for a classic episode of the show. Today we are airing part two of the one that came out last weekend. So this is Devourer of Memories, part two, originally published November 21st, 2019. It continues the story from last weekend, so we hope you enjoy.
Let's dig right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our exploration of planarians, memory, learning, and conditioning. And of course, today we're going to get to the cannibalism.
That's right. If you did not listen to part one, do go back and listen to it because we lay the groundwork. We discuss these organisms, why they're interesting. We discuss their regenerative powers. We talk about McConnell himself. We talk about his personal and professional history, as well as his run-in with the Unabomber.
Right. So that figure, of course, is James V. McConnell, the American psychologist. But if you listened to the last episode, as you should before this one, you already know that. So we're picking up after McConnell's initial research demonstrating in the 1950s that despite conventional wisdom that invertebrates could not learn, could not be trained through classical conditioning or any other kind of associative learning, McConnell and colleagues did in fact demonstrate that that's not true, at least for planarians, these flatworms that that could be trained to react to something like a light stimulus. And we also discussed how it's just generally known to be true today that invertebrates can learn. The conventional wisdom at the time was wrong. But so to pick up with McConnell's career, after completing his graduate degree at the University of Texas, James McConnell moved on to the University of Michigan, where he continued his research into flatworms with a team that came to be known as the Planarian Research Group, or PRG. So another piece of context for this research is a sort of quest for the Holy Grail within 20th century psychology and neuroscience. And this was the hunt for the elusive engram. It was believed by many in the mid-century that a researcher, the first researcher to actually pinpoint something known as the engram, would receive the Nobel Prize for their work. But what was the engram? The short version is that the engram was believed to be the fundamental physical unit of memory represented in the body. In order for an animal to learn an association between two things, that memory has to be accompanied by some kind of physical change inside the body. But what is the fundamental unit of that change? Is it a structural change in the brain that can be located, or is it something else?
So the idea is that you would see the physical evidence of learning.
Yeah.
And then potentially, like, that is physical evidence that could be then manipulated.
Of course, yeah. It's sort of like searching for the atom. What the atom is to matter, the engram would be to memory. Mm-hmm. What is the fundamental unit that physically indicates in the body a memory has been formed? And of course, one motivation for studying whether simpler organisms like worms and other invertebrates could in fact learn associations through classical conditioning was that this might help move along the search for the engram. If a biological phenomenon seems too complex to understand in one organism, you know, if you can't find it in a rabbit, everything's just too complicated, maybe you can get a foothold to understanding by looking for analogous phenomena in simpler organisms and then build your way back up.
Yeah, and this is sensible. Way to go about it.
Of course. So research in the middle of the 20th century tried to locate the engram to changes in a specific part of the brain in a rat, but these efforts failed. In fact, rat brain memory research demonstrated that there was no one location or structure in which the fundamental unit of memory association was to be found. Instead, learning seemed to involve wide swaths of the rat cortex. And today we know that certain regions of the brain are especially important for memories. For example, fear-based conditioning, like if you condition somebody to respond to a stimulus through conditioning due to an electric shock. This seems to strongly implicate the amygdala, not just fear actually, but other types of emotional memory as well, I think. While memory of spatial locations and physical maps seems especially to implicate the hippocampus. But memories for complex actions, maybe finding your way around a maze, as was often tried with rats, will involve lots of different parts of the brain at once. So you can't point to the memory in one specific part of the brain. It's using the whole brain, basically. In the 1950s, this wasn't yet clear. It was just clear that memory, contrary to the expectations of many psychologists, couldn't be located in one particular structure or single point physical change in the brain. And because of the failure of researchers to locate a structural engram at a single point in the brain, some researchers began to turn to other explanations, and McConnell was one of them. McConnell wondered, what if memories were not stored exclusively in structures in the brain? Could you have memories in your hands, in your blood, in your guts? Was there a deeper chemical rather than structural basis for our memories? And here's where the planarians again become an invaluable research tool in looking into, could you have memories outside the brain? Could there be such a thing as a memory chemical or a memory molecule found throughout the body?
And this we come back to the regenerative powers of the planarian. We described this in the first episode as being something like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, the old Disney animation from Fantasia, in which the it's a broom that is brought to life to do a particular task.
Water from a well, I think.
Yeah,
something
and then,
like that.
Yeah, it's a well. And then Mickey, the sorcerer's apprentice in this case, ends up having to destroy it. So he chops it into a million pieces with his axe. And then all those millions of pieces, each little sliver of the broom comes back to life and grows into a whole new, fresh broom that walks around on two legs and carries buckets of water.
Right. And this connects to the regenerative powers of planaria, because if you cut a planarian in half, one of these flatworms, just chop it in half, crosswise, separating the head from the tail, each half of the worm would grow back the part it lost. So the decapitated head could regrow a tail, and the decapitated tail could regrow a head, which means regrowing a brain. So McConnell's question was, if I condition a flatworm to learn something, maybe have a response to a stimulus like a flashing light, and then I cut it in half, which half of the worm will retain the response, if either? Now, you might think the answer is obvious, right? Well, obviously, the head half is where the brain is. So the head half will retain the conditioning if either side does, and the tail half won't, right? That seems like the obvious conclusion.
Right. Yeah, that's what you would assume. That's what like a basic understanding of monster movies would have you assume.
Yes. McConnell found this was not exactly true. In his experiments on freshwater flatworms called Dugesia doradocephala, if you classically condition the worm to respond to a light, and then you cut the flatworm into two halves, both halves retained the conditioning. And in a few cases, the tail retained the conditioning more strongly than the head.
Oh, wow.
So you could cut the head off, the tail would regrow a head, and it would still respond like the way it had learned to respond when it had its original head. So if all the learning was in the brain, how could that be possible?
Right. This would seem to indicate that there's some sort of memory retention or memory storage going on within the body itself.
Right. And these results were eventually published in the Journal of Comparative and Physiological Psychology. But then it gets even weirder because we're going to start playing Flatworm Ship of Theseus. So a refresher on the Ship of Theseus thought experiment. Robert, do you want to do the honors here?
Oh, sure. This is the basic idea. If you you have this ship, this legendary Ship of Theseus, you're celebrating it across the decades. Mm-hmm. The thing about it is a ship that is docked for decades tends to fall apart piece by piece. So you replace it piece by piece. Eventually, you reach the point where you have replaced every single piece of this vessel. The question is the Ship of Theseus any longer the Ship of Theseus? It's not physically the same ship it was before, but it is the same shape. It's just all the pieces have been at this point replaced.
Now, what if you in fact do this with flatworms since they can regenerate? And this is exactly what they tried. In a series of experiments, McConnell and the Planarian Research Group showed that if you cut a worm, like for example, you cut a flatworm's head off after it's been conditioned and trained, so it has this memory response, and then that tail regrows a head, and then you cut the original tail off, so the regenerated head regrows a tail, now you've got no original part of the worm left. So you've been through these multiple generations of cutting a worm apart and letting it regenerate, and yet their experiments found that some learning, training, memory was retained across the multiple generations where there was no original part of the worm left. Again, how would this be possible? Like, if memories are stored exclusively in the brain, how could a memory necessary to establish a conditioned response still operate within a tail that had its head cut off, or a segment of a worm grown from a segment of a worm grown from a segment of a worm that had been through the conditioning? And this led McConnell to suppose that he had evidence that memory may have strong chemical components that are not limited to activity within the brain. There could be actual molecules of chemical memory coursing through the worm's body. Now, if this were true, this would, of course, be a revolutionary discovery, right?
Right. Because it would conceivably apply to other organisms. I mean, that's the thing. It might force us to completely rethink what we thought we knew about memory.
Right. And of course, if it were true of flatworms, it's possible it would only be true of flatworms. But yeah, you don't know where else this would lead. Could it even be true of more complex animals? So it was this line of research about cut up flatworms retaining memories that led actually to the founding of the magazine we talked about in the last episode, The Worm Runner's Digest. This was McConnell's magazine that quite strangely combined both real research on planarians. It was like real flatworm research published alongside weird poems and joke articles and satirical articles and stuff.
It's such a weird title. The worm part clearly relates to the worm experiments, but it also brings to mind like Blade Runner, except it's Worm Runner, and it also makes me think of various Gary Larson Far Side cartoons in which a worm is perhaps, you know, wearing sweatpants and running.
That's good, but the joke in the title is actually a reference to like common terms used by psychologists of this period. Lots of research about learning and memory involved rats and mazes.
Oh,
and
running
such.
The maze.
And so researchers who did this kind of work referred to themselves jokingly in the 1950s as rat runners. McConnell's variation is self-explanatory.
Ah, Jerry, the worm runner. Okay, I got it.
Not Jerry. You're thinking Jerry O'Connell. Ah, no, James McConnell.
I got Jerry myself there. James the worm runner then.
But coming back. So this led to the founding of this strange magazine that he became very well known for. The story as summarized by Larry Stern, and I mentioned several sources at the beginning of the last episode. We're still referring to those sources in this episode. One was an article by Larry Stern that talked about the founding of this magazine. So in 1959, McConnell presented some of this work about chopping up flatworms and then supposedly retaining memories to an annual convention of the American Psychological Association, the APA. And this included results collected by a member of the Planarian Research Group named Reva Jacobson. And again, this research showed that not only could a decapitated flatworm retain associative learning, but essentially the ship of Theseus flatworm containing no tissue of the original worm could also retain learning. And after the presentation, Newsweek published an article summarizing the research. This led to a huge surge of popular interest in McConnell's work. And so Larry Stern writes, quote, "Shortly after the Newsweek coverage, McConnell was inundated with letters from high school students from around the country asking where they could obtain worms for their projects and how they should go about caring for and training them. Some students, according to McConnell, demanded that he send them a few hundred trained worms at once as their projects were due within days." Sounds a little familiar, right? Students don't do things like this. But McConnell did want to help students conduct their own flatworm research. I get the feeling he was into this idea, but he realized very quickly that it didn't make sense to try to respond to each letter individually. So instead, he decided to publish a manual on how to replicate the experiments performed by the PRG, and he titled this document The Worm Runner's Digest. However, after publishing this manual under that title, McConnell started getting submissions to appear in future issues. So he began publishing this so-called journal on a regular basis, again, including both real research and psychological in-jokes, cartoons, poems, and all that kind of stuff.
Interesting. So it's kind of accidentally became a continuing publication.
Yeah. Now, as you can imagine, some people didn't take kindly to this mix of subject matter. In 1964, after some readers complained that they couldn't tell the real research from the jokes and the satire, they started publishing the satirical elements upside down in the back half of the journal. So there was some attempt there to clear up the confusion. But I think for a lot of scientists, the pure proximity of the different material was a problem, no matter how clear the division.
Well, I think that's understandable. We talked before about the Ig Nobel Prizes, for instance, about how most of the individuals involved and honored by these prizes that celebrate, you know, scientific studies that are legitimate scientific studies, but that are on some level humorous or amusing. But you still have some individuals in the scientific world who do not see the value of that at all.
Sure.
So if feathers are ever ruffled by the Ig Nobel Prizes, obviously something like this would ruffle feathers as well.
Yes. So then in 1967, there came another split where the serious half of the journal was just formally cleaved and renamed. In fact, cloven in half like a flatworm, chopped right off, decapitated. The serious half was renamed the Journal of Biological Psychology, and the Worm Runner's Digest became the sole haven of humor, and it continued publishing that way until 1979.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be right back.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery. But that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, so to jump back into the progression of James McConnell's research, we're brought back to this question of a non-brain chemical basis for memory. Could memory, or at least some memories, some types of memories, be stored chemically rather than structurally, dispersed in the body in molecules? And here's where we get to the cannibalism. So, if there were, in fact, molecules within an animal representing some kind of chemical memory, such as memory of how to navigate a maze, could this be demonstrated? Could those molecules be shared from one animal to another?
And this makes sense. That's what creatures do. They take molecules from each other, from other organisms, and put them into themselves.
Sure. We absorb the molecules existing in other organisms for nutrition. Mm-hmm. Could molecules be absorbed from one organism to another for memory transfer? So the first method they tried, and this is based on the reporting of one of those Larry Stern articles, the first method they tried was to splice the head of a conditioned worm onto the tail of an unconditioned worm to see if it would share molecules, right, to force them to exchange the alleged memory molecules. But the transplant did not work. The head would not stay attached. Then they tried to liquefy fully conditioned flatworms and inject their juice into untrained worms, but this was also difficult. The planarians were too small to be injected, basically, and sometimes they exploded when injected. In Larry Stern's words, quote, "It was like trying to impale a prune with a javelin."
A lot of horrific things done to planarians in these experiments.
I guess they're simple enough organisms that we don't have to be horrified, upset
about them, I guess. But still, one can't help but pause a little on some of these.
Right. Some of the grinding. Yeah. the sauce, the gravy, the flatworm sauce. So how do you get those hypothetical memory molecules in there if you can't inject them, you can't transplant a head on? So the next route they tried, and this was in the year 1960, was experimental planarian cannibalism.
This would be the old-fashioned way of getting molecules from one organism into the other.
Sure. So apparently the idea came from a flatworm researcher named J. Boyd Best, who communicated to McConnell about the fact that one particular species of planarian was known for cannibalistic behavior. So here's the answer. You train the worms to respond to a maze or to the light, whatever the conditioning stimulus is, and then they learn the conditioning, and then you grind them up into worm gravy, and then you feed the worm gravy to the untrained, naive worms, and you see what happens. And astonishingly, their early experiments with this method looked very promising, including a number of early replication attempts with blinding procedures to remove the possibility of experimenter bias, supposedly confirming their early results. So if it were true that memory molecules are being exchanged through this strange cannibalistic ritual, could I, you know, would this extend to humans? Could I drink your flesh and gain your memories? Mm. And how was it happening? What was the chemical basis here? So one interesting line of reasoning here followed from the still somewhat recent discoveries about genetic information being stored in and mediated by nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. Remember, you know, we're not too far from the discovery of the double helix here.
Oh, yes.
So if DNA and RNA could be involved in an information management process, passing genetic information across generations from parents to offspring, could the same molecules also encode and mediate other types of information? I mean, information is in the DNA. So specifically, could the information content of memories somehow be coded into DNA or RNA and then dispersed through the body, but also transferred from one body to another? And so this is the line they took. McConnell and his team conducted experiments and published results that seemed to back up the idea, at least for a while, that RNA played some important role in facilitating memory and that RNA could be used to chemically inoculate naive worms with the memory associations of their more worldly predecessors. And again, just consider how revolutionary this would be if it turned out to be true. You'd be forced to wonder how far the principle could be taken. Did this only apply to planarians, or did it extend to other more complex animals? Would there be ways in which humans could undergo chemical learning? Could you train the mind in some way with an injection alone or even a pill? Even if it only worked for like broad associative learning, such as, you know, the kind of things you get through classical conditioning with an electric shock and a single stimulus, mm-hmm. you could still possibly imagine profound benefits. Just one idea comes to mind, like, say you're struggling with a drug addiction. Could you seek out an injection of memory molecules to establish a strong adverse reaction to your drug of choice such that you wouldn't want to take it anymore?
Yeah, or to get into some of the behavioralist ideas that we discussed in the first episode, some of those ideas that McConnell was very outspoken about even later in life, you could have some sort of a cocktail that could be injected into an individual that had a history of violence and a history of breaking the law and rebelling mm-hmm. against authority figures, and you could potentially fix them with this injection.
Yeah, and of course there you get into the more nefarious possible thing. Like you can probably instantaneously imagine so many horrible, insidious uses for injectable conditioning, if such a thing were possible.
Oh, yes. I mean, as with any science, many, many fabulous uses come to mind, but so many nightmares as well.
But we should stop and be real for a second here that even if these findings had turned out to be totally solid for planaria, and more on that in a moment, we should know better than to freely extrapolate from worms to humans. I think this is one of the most classic traps that people fall into when interpreting biological research. I'd say more often it's people extrapolating from like rats to humans, but this isn't a much larger jump. This isn't even a vertebrate animal.
Yeah, I mean, you can't help. I often find that I can't help but at least think about that on some level when I read a science headline. I can't help but put myself into it somehow and imagine myself as the creature.
Right, and it's often, I mean, it's just done right there in the press. Again, it's fine to wonder about what possibilities could be implied by studies in rats for humans, but you can't just, you know, conclude from one to another.
Yeah, we can't help but anthropomorphize virtually any creature. Uh-huh. And if that creature is in a study, we're also going to end up anthropomorphizing that as well.
But James McConnell, true to form, as we know from the last episode, was not one to be shy or cautious about interpreting his findings. He loudly proclaimed them to the public, advertising his results on TV programs. He apparently embraced the nickname McCannibal.
Oh, nice.
And he predicted an era of memory pills like we just discussed. So you might be thinking, like, wait a minute, he should know better than to extrapolate from planarian, even if you assume the planarian research to be 100% solid, and we'll introduce some caveats to that. But even if you did assume that, how could you jump from that to human memory pills? It seems like a leap of miles of assumptions.
Yeah, very much so.
And it does seem from what I was reading, especially in Rilling's paper about McConnell, that it seemed like to him, he sort of had a sense of humor about talking about memory pills, like as if he were sort of joking when he talked about memory pills, but that was not clear to the popular audience that was listening on the TV. You know, they weren't psychologists. They didn't understand that he was kind of kidding when he said that. Does
right.
that make sense?
Oh, certainly. And then also there are going to be like a few different levels. Like it's like he may joke about it here in this paper or joke about it to this individual, but then you're going to have different levels of coverage and it's going to get out of control pretty quickly.
Yes. So Rilling writes that, quote, McConnell's work on retention following regeneration in planaria provides a case study in sensational journalism and illustrates how his media work escaped the normal mechanisms of peer review. So the idea is that McConnell and colleagues would do an experiment. They would obtain a very strange and interesting result that looked solid enough to get published in an academic journal. And then McConnell would immediately want to engage in, quote, wild sounding conjectures, interpreting the meaning of his results and how they would be applied in the future. And scientific journals generally, like one example was the editor, Harry Harlow, generally refused to publish these wild interpretive or speculative addendums to the research. They just say, well, we'll publish your study, but you got to cut out this section about memory pills that doesn't belong mm-hmm. in here. But of course, there's no peer review in the popular media, so he could go on TV and say memory pills as much as he wanted. And it turned out that that kind of thing on TV gets you booked on TV again because it's exciting, right? I mean, that's like something that people can picture. It's not hard to understand, and it's very like revolutionary.
That's what you want in a science segment on your news programs. You want something relatable. And here's this guy that is making it relatable and exciting.
With promises that are not at all implied by the research being discussed, even if the research itself is 100% solid. And retrospectively, that may be in doubt. So just one example, in 1959, an article in Newsweek covering McConnell and the PRG research claimed, it may be that in schools of the future, students will facilitate the ability to retain information with chemical injections. Apparently, there was also a lot of misunderstanding in the media, misunderstanding the fact that multiple generations of regenerated planaria could retain training. And they misunderstood this as the fact that memories can be inherited in a parent-to-child sense, which led to all kinds of Lamarckian interpretation. Mm. So I think there was also just confusion stemming from the use of the word inherited and generations. He was talking about like generations being chopped up and regenerating, which is quite different than what we understand.
Right. And again, he's coming down – he's talking about memories here. There are other things that, you know, there's certainly things that affect that have generational effects mm-hmm. in biology and in human biology. I think we've talked about studies before and about body size following periods of starvation, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Sure.
But again, we are talking about memories here. He is explicitly talking about memory.
Yes. And another one that was quoted in Rilling was regarding cannibalistic memory transfer, the one where you eat the worm gravy and you gain that worm's memories, supposedly. Mm-hmm. There was a 1964 article in the Saturday Evening Post that claimed we, quote, it might someday enable us to learn the piano by taking a pill or to take calculus by injection, which at that point is a very crude, gross kind of like overinterpretation of what the memories here are and the, you know, the leap from one organism to another.
You just like do a line of ground up Beethoven. And
yeah.
I mean, this is so outrageous that like I feel like I would feel like I was overstretching to use this as an outrageous example of a possibility. You know, like earlier I did the far future example of criminals being treated. Like this seems crazier.
Right.
But on the same hand, also attractive, the idea of being able to, say, master calculus by simply injecting something into your body.
Yeah, though I hope also our questions about potential applications, if this were true, were heavily caveated enough. So in the mid-1960s, there were even studies following up on this cannibalism research, claiming to bear out chemical memory transfer in other species, such as in rats. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, that's kind of hard to believe. And so like for a few years there in the 60s, things looked incredibly promising with this research. But fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, it was not to last. There was a problem with the PRG's cannibalistic memory transfer research, and it was just that it didn't hold up to sustained scrutiny over time. Over time, properly blinded and controlled efforts to replicate McConnell's results, a few of them came in saying, yeah, we replicated, but a lot did not produce the same effects for cannibalism or other chemical methods of memory transfer. According to Rilling, in 1971, I guess this would be as a result of some of these failures, the Planarian Research Group lost its grant support, and this led McConnell to change focus. And after this, in the 70s, he went on to write a very influential and, from what I can tell, mostly well-regarded textbook for introductory psychology. Apparently, one thing that set it apart in the field was that it used a lot of fiction. It introduced students to psychological research methods with the use of stories and like fictional framing narratives to explain the principles that were discussed in each chapter, even including one chapter about memory. It seems to begin with a fictionalized version of the story of his research with Thompson in 1954, 55 or so, though incorporating lessons about control groups that he had not learned very well back then.
Huh.
And as we discussed more in the previous episode, later in his career, I think he was known more maybe for being a fierce public advocate of the powers of behavior modification through conditioning. Again, this was an era in which behaviorist psychology was seen by many as a potentially revolutionary scientific tool for minute control of human minds and lives. This is the birth of the modern concept of brainwashing, right? And McConnell wrote and appeared on TV arguing that behavioral conditioning would fundamentally alter the nature of criminal justice and democratic society itself. I think there was one article he wrote that was titled something like, "We Must Brainwash Criminals Now."
Well, that's a great headline, though. No doubt about it.
Yeah. Certainly, if you want to get the clicks. Yeah. He was on, maybe he was clickbait before the internet existed.
He does. He does seem very clickbaity.
And this is something some of his colleagues said about them. It was quoted in the Rilling paper that he wanted to shock people. He wanted to say things that would make people say, "What? What's this guy talking about? That can't be true." And he said, you know, the idea was you bring people in by shocking them and then you educate them with the science.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess that can be an okay method if what you say in order to shock people isn't fundamentally dishonest in some way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it kind of gets into a similar area of like leading with an example, you know, and sometimes it's an outrageous example. Sometimes, like on this show, we bring up a monster, something fantastic, and we use that to talk about something that is real and talk about actual scientific studies or actual biology that somehow matches up to that. But
well, I hope we never do. I hope if we start with Godzilla, we don't leave you with the impression at the end of the episode that Godzilla is real and true.
Right. Yeah. But it is interesting how it seems like some of the things that did make him such a great communicator and ultimately like a great author of an introductory psychology book, those are also some of the things that got him in trouble.
Yeah, that totally seems to be true based on everything I've read. But coming back to the memory transfer issue, I just want to say that I think the conclusion, unfortunately, at the end is that the cannibalistic memory transfer saga is widely regarded now as a dead end. Despite a few reports of moderate replication successes, McConnell's results ultimately did not hold up to widespread scrutiny and the rigorous application of controls by others, and it looks like his supposed discoveries about memory transfer through injection or cannibalism were probably wrong. But not all of his conclusions were necessarily wrong. I mean, again, one of the points of Rilling's article seems to be that despite the ultimate failure of the memory transfer through cannibalism theory, McConnell did make truly important contributions to research on invertebrate learning in the 1950s. And while the memory transfer or the memory molecule transfer through cannibalism is almost definitely a dead end, more recent studies have sort of raised the question of whether his like decapitation and transplantation research might have been on the right track.
All right, we're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to discuss some of these modern follow-ups regarding planarian decapitation and brain transplant.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
All right, we're back. So we discussed through the end of the career of James V. McConnell, who studied planarians, memory transfer, or memories outside of the brain. And we brought up the idea that this subject has been revisited by researchers just in the past few years who think that while McConnell was probably wrong about, like, say, eating flatworms and gaining their memories, there may be some truth to the idea of memory somehow being stored outside the brain or transferred without a full brain.
Yeah. So, for instance, it has been demonstrated that if you transplant a planarian's brain into another worm's body, it will result in at least partial recovery of function, even if the brain is put in backwards or transplanted across species. The author Pagan, who we brought up earlier, who wrote The First Brain, he points this out. And he points out that basically the cross-species transplants held, meaning there was no rejection. And 48 hours later, the worm retained mostly normal behavior.
I mean, that's pretty weird, but again, it's worms, I guess.
Right. Yeah, one of the big take-homes from all of this is that planarian brains and planarians in general are strange.
Right. So a lot of what we determine, a lot of what we learn from this research, you could interpret as some fascinating deeper insight about biology as a whole, or you could interpret it as fascinating specific facts about these flatworms.
Absolutely. So in particular, though, Pagan and others are referring to a 1985 study by Davies et al. And they were working with a species of planarian that actually can't regenerate brain tissue. But a transplanted brain will take root. And, quote, nerves exiting the brain tended to join with the peripheral nerves closest to them, which I think is a wonderful image of the brain being implanted in this creature, and then like roots forming, like the vein, like it connects itself, it hooks itself up like a car battery that has been placed in inside another a new vehicle, and all the things just kind of hook up automatically,
plug and play.
Yeah,
well, or like mistletoe or some other kind of parasite that like sticks its little haustorium or whatever, the little spikes down into the host.
Yeah, it's weird. It's definitely not the human experience. I mean, not to discuss a whole body transplant or a human brain and head transplant much in this episode, but basically, it's very complicated, if not impossible, in humans.
Yeah. To look at memory more broadly, neuroscientists today mostly broadly understand memories to be neural networks, right? Networks within the brain, sort of strings of reinforced connections between neurons and brain regions that specify memories by their cross-linked structure. A memory is in some way a series of connections between neurons in the brain. That does seem to be the case. Beyond that broad picture, there's still a lot we don't know about the physical basis of memory. And so even in especially in organisms like flatworms, there are ways in which memory could be operating that are still mysterious to us.
Right. Now, of course, the quest to solve these mysteries continues. A great deal of planarian research is still going on. And you'll see quite a bit of it come out of Tufts University. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a researcher by the name of Michael Levin.
Yeah.
Often is a head author or a co-author or contributing author on these papers.
Yeah. And there was one big study that got some press being connected back to McConnell's research that Levin was at least one of the authors on. And basically it had to do with replicating a version of the decapitation experiment, showing that somehow it appeared memory – if the study was designed properly and there wasn't some kind of flaw that people didn't notice in there, that memories maybe were somehow being transferred through the decapitation process.
Right. This was a 2013 Tufts University study that found that a decapitated flatworm that grows a new head keeps its old memories. For instance, the Sarah Zhang article about this that appeared in Nautilus carried the title "Decapitation, but not cannibalism, might transmit memories."
Without context, that's a pretty weird title.
Right. But within context, the article refers back to McConnell's work quite a bit. And the idea here is that some trace of of memory might be stored in neural circuits outside the brain. And certainly when you take that and you compare it to these, to this previous study with one brain being dropped into a new creature, a new individual, and seeing it, take root and seemingly bounce back, that becomes all the more interesting.
Yeah. One of the things that has clearly been the case, and this was discussed in that article in The Verge we talked about in the last episode, is that Levin's research has been focused on trying to eliminate some of the problems that could have existed in the original McConnell research. One example is that he helped create a thing called an automatic training apparatus. Basically, it's a robot for conditioning the flatworms to take the human element out of the training process to eliminate any kind of bias or error that could be introduced that way. But I love the idea in general of a robot for training worms.
Yes. So that 2013 study especially generated quite a bit of interest. And at the time, there was mixed response from the scientific community. Now, I do want to drive home that it is not my interpretation that Michael Levin is anything like a McConnell figure. He seems to be a very respected researcher. And most of his work, you're seeing on a lot of studies for just general planaria research.
Right. No, I mean – I haven't seen anything where Michael Levin is going on TV and saying memory pills.
Right. And by and large, it seems like most of his work just deals with regeneration in these planaria worms. So you had plenty of people though that were supportive and thought that they might be onto something. Others were a little critical at the time. Robert Kentridge was a psychologist at Durham University, and he pointed out in a 2015 Verge article, that Verge article we cited earlier, that it might be simply related to, quote, behavior induced by a stress hormone itself triggered by the textualized petri dishes, unquote.
And to clarify there, part of what the study looked at to see conditioning in the flatworms was you'd have these textured petri dishes where they would be swimming around the food they were going to eat. Mm-hmm. And how fast they approached the food in a newly textured petri dish environment was taken as a signal of their memory or familiarity with the environment. Like you put a new flatworm in a textured petri dish, it circles for a while before going for the food because it's exploring its environment. It doesn't know. But after it's been trained with the texture in a petri dish, it goes straight for the food because it already knows the environment.
Right, yes. So basically, a number of individuals said, well, there are aspects of the study that could have been better designed.
Sure.
Now, again, Michael Levin, his research continues, and you'll find a number of studies from very recently that he's been involved with. He was an author on a study earlier this year, Neural Control of Body Plan Axis in Regenerating Planaria. And in 2015, he put out a paper on the planarian regeneration model as deciphered by artificial intelligence. And that same year, he was also a co-author on another study that included the growth of extra heads.
Yeah. I've seen also that I think both within and outside of planaria, he's just generally studied regeneration.
Yeah. And with the planaria, of course, it's just such an amazingly regenerative creature. You get things like this the second study that I mentioned from 2015, they were able to induce one species of flatworm to grow heads and brains characteristic of another species of flatworm without altering genomic sequence, and then the individual later regenerated to the appropriate head shape.
Huh. Now, quickly, I guess one thing worth discussing is if the research associated with Michael Levin is in fact correct, the results are valid, there's not some kind of flaw we're missing in the design of the study, and this is really going on, the memories are surviving the regeneration without an original brain – how would you interpret this? Like, what does it mean if this is in fact true? So a couple of ideas are given in that 2015 Verge article. Levin, quote, hypothesizes that memories could spread beyond the brain thanks to electrical charges generated by cells in the rest of the body. So there's some kind of information encoding that's just like coming from cells in the other body that are electrically stimulating something like a memory response. Hmm. But then there's another thing cited in the same piece by Ava Jablonka, a developmental biologist at Tel Aviv University. And she offers a speculative explanation involving particles called, quote, small RNAs, which are short copies of DNA, but they don't turn into proteins. They don't generate proteins. So when a flatworm learns an association or an episode, something in this model about the brain chemistry would change, and then these changes alter the small RNAs present in the body, which of course are not confined to the brain because they migrate around between cells. And by migrating around between cells, she says perhaps they end up in stem cells that remain in the body after the worm's head is cut off. And to read from the article, quote, when the worm's head grows back, the small RNAs migrate back to the head, changing the brain's chemistry and allowing it to learn certain behaviors more quickly. If true, the memory that Levin thinks is stored outside the brain wouldn't be memory at all. Rather, the small RNAs would allow the flatworm to recover a brain environment that helps them learn a specific behavior more quickly. So the idea there is that if this speculative idea is correct, and again, she's very clear to state this isn't something we know, it's just a speculative interpretation. Maybe it works this way. Then what would be happening is these little chemical molecules don't transmit the memory, prepare the new brain to learn a memory that was previously learned more quickly.
Hmm. Okay. So at least we have a hypothetical model of how this would actually work, or at least here's one model presented anyway.
Sure. But ultimately, we don't know for sure. And again, another thing that we don't know for sure is if these results do hold up, is this something that's specific to planaria? Is mm-hmm. it flatworms only that can transfer memories in this way? Or could this be more applicable beyond flatworms to other organisms?
Yeah, because that's the thing. Other organisms can't regenerate like a planaria can. But at the same time, one of the things that's often cited for researching planaria regeneration is that we might learn something that could be applicable to humans.
Of course.
Without even getting into memory implantation, just the idea that they have such impressive neural regenerative powers, the ability to regenerate like damaged brain cells. You know, if we could develop some better method of doing that based on our studies of these organisms, then that would be tremendous.
Of course. When you introduce the idea of brain regeneration or anything like that to a human context, things emerge that don't necessarily seem to be of concern when you're talking about planaria. Mm-hmm. Planaria don't seem to have extremely distinct personalities. Mm-hmm. Humans do. However much we want to joke about humans acting like sheep and all being the same, we've got a lot of different stuff going on in our heads. If you cut your head off and regrew it, what indication would you have that the new head would be you in any sense other than sharing your DNA?
Well, I guess as long as it said all the right things, and, it would just get along fine. It would be like a pea zombie, perhaps.
Uh-huh. I guess it would be a question of whether it would retain any memories from your life. You could talk about whether that might be stored in the body somehow, or even if you assume, it retains no memories whatsoever because those are just stored in the brain. Whatever may or may not be happening in flatworms doesn't happen at all in humans. Even if you assume all that, you'd also have to ask, like, would its personality be the same as yours? Personality is so shaped by life experience. I don't know.
Huh. It makes me wonder, has anyone ever considered creating a science fiction yarn in which you look at what would human society be like if we had regenerative properties like this? Mm-hmm. Like, what would war be like? What would reproduction in society be like? I mean, granted, I think the obvious answer, it would absolutely change everything.
Right.
But the fun thing about science fiction is you don't have to go all the way. You can just sort of like tweak it. Like, what would this if I were to look at this particular vision for a totally regenerative planarian human species, then what could I perhaps unravel about our actual human condition?
Well, I mean, I think we pretty much all at some state, at some point or other, get into a place where we're not very happy with our own brain. We don't mm-hmm. like the emotional patterns we're feeling. Maybe we're ruminating in bad ways. I mean, this happens pretty often to people. So what if you had the option to, you get into a bad state like that, you know you can just cut your head off and grow a new one?
These are exactly what the horrifying orange creatures in Labyrinth are all about when they they come up to Sarah and they encourage her, hey, take your own head off, throw it around, try on a different head, let your head try itself out on a different body, see how it shakes out, just, you know, have a little fun.
You're not a flatworm. Don't try it, people.
All right. We're going to go ahead and close this out then. But we hope that you have enjoyed and learned from this exploration. Perhaps you'll think of flatworms in a new light now, and perhaps you will even second-guess memory a little bit as well. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find them at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. And you can also find our podcast, heck, just about everywhere else. Anywhere you get the podcast, though, we do ask that you leave us a nice review. Leave us some stars, that sort of thing. Make sure you've subscribed. That kind of thing really helps us out in the long run. Also, if you want other shows that we're involved with, There is invention. Invention is a journey through human techno history, one invention at a time. Go check that out. It's at inventionpod.com, and you can also find it anywhere you get your podcast. Just look up Invention. If you want a little serialized horror sci-fi for your holiday season, check out The Second Oil Age. That is out as well. And I'm also told that the Stuff to Blow Your Mind t-shirt shop is not only still around, it has been around, and it still has all those wonderful squirrel and basilisk and bicameral mind designs, as well as our logo designs. But there's going to be a new logo for the Thanksgiving-ish holiday, and there's going to be some sort of a sale coming up.
Right. If you got a friend or family member who's a fan of the show, you want to get them a holiday gift, maybe you should get them a Sphere Catastrophique shirt or a Squirrels Are Not What They Seem shirt. Any one of the many wonderful offerings we've got for you right in the merch place. So go into the merch pit. Come out with treasures. Anyway, huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.